Welcome to this week's edition of By the Book here at the Nahum Segal Network. You're listening at jmnam.org and or nahumsegal.com, and I greatly appreciate you tuning in Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time for the first run program of a By the Book, which you could hear at various times during the week. I want to remind everybody we're in the midst right now of the JM and the AM WFMU Fundraising Marathon, the 2014 edition. That is the support, or I should say the drive, that supports the most important flagship program of this entire network. And if you have not yet gone ahead and set aside some funds and contributed to that effort, please go to jmnam.org. Again, that's jmnam.org. And you can click on the pledge box at the top and participate with us in the 2014 pledge drive. Today we have an amazing opportunity to speak with Dr. Richard Grazi. Dr. Grazi is the author of the book Overcoming Infertility, A Guide for Jewish Couples. This is a Toby Press release. I want to thank our friends at Koren Publications for making Dr. Grazi available for this conversation. Information about the book, you can go to tobypress.com, T-O-B-Y, press.com, and get more information. At a time when medical advances in fertility treatment are being made with unprecedented speed, Jewish couples are finding themselves psychologically and ethically challenged. Overcoming Infertility is an indispensable reference book for couples, rabbis, and counselors trying to understand and resolve the complex issues of fertility therapy. This thorough and sensitive work examines contemporary technologies as they relate to halacha, the particular psychological and social issues faced by Jewish couples grappling with infertility, and the intersections of physical and spiritual aspects of overcoming infertility to give couples the guidance and hope they need to fulfill the profound human desire to have children. Dr. Richard Grazi is director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at Maimonides Medical Center and founder of Genesis Fertility and Reproductive Medicine in New York. He's been recognized for six consecutive years by New York Magazine as a best doctor for reproductive medicine. His first book was Be Fruitful and Multiply, Fertility Therapy and the Jewish Tradition. Dr. Richard Grazi, welcome to the Nahum Segal Network.
Thank you so much for your kind invitation. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
I appreciate that. At what point does a young medical student decide that they're heading into this era, into this area, of specialty?
Oh, that's a very leading question, especially for me, because it was after my first year of medical school that I decided to become a reproductive endocrinologist. That's unusual, actually. Most reproductive endocrinologists start out as generalists in an OBGYN residency, and sometime along the way, they recognize the very special nature of this field and decide to do further fellowship training in reproductive endocrinology. But what happened for me is that after my first year of medical school, Louise Brown, the first test tube baby, so-called, was born. And that was in July 1978. Okay, I've just dated myself. but when that happened, it was a very special moment for me. I would say it was an epiphanous moment for me because I realized how very special that occasion was and how the nature of medicine, the nature of human reproduction as we knew it, was going to be changed forever.
Right.
And that was one of the ways that I decided to make my career in this field.
Yeah, not that the date of your graduation was required or that we need to explore your age, but I'm glad you gave us that mark in terms of when that took place, because I would assume even since then, with as big a step as that was in the entire area, even since then, things I would assume have changed like crazy in the area.
They do. It's a very, very rapidly moving medicine. It's what we call translational science, so that things move very rapidly from the research arena into clinical medicine. And there have been major breakthroughs along the way, one of which was learning how to freeze embryos. The second was just getting the success rates up. And for that, we altered the technique from the Louise Brown days when we were just using a single egg grown in a natural cycle to the way that most IVF is done today, which has success rates not in the Louise Brown arena where the success came after 100 tries. Nobody would accept a treatment that has a 1% success rate.
Right.
Today, most young couples who go through IVF, I mean by that where the woman is less than the age of 35, would have a greater than a 50% chance of becoming pregnant on one cycle.
Is your involvement, and at that time especially in the 70s, your involvement in our community and just, you know, being a member of our community, do you think that that lent a special sensitivity to you going into this area? Or you met plenty of people who are far away from, I don't know, religious observance or anything having to do with the perpetuation of our generation who also explored this area with great interest?
Well, it's a complicated question. I will tell you that one of the reasons that I decided to go into this field was not only because of the exciting science behind it and the dramatic impact that you can have on the lives of couples who are having trouble having children and the echo effect that that has throughout the generations when they are successful, because you're building more than just their immediate family, but you're helping with their future families as well.
Right.
What also was clearly understood, even at the time, was that there were tremendous ethical problems greeted together with the announcement of Louise Brown's birth, and that translated into halakhic problems for our immediate community. And one of the things that called to me was that my own mission would be to help to translate those halakhic problems into, when I could, halakhic solutions by interacting with rabbanim in the community and by working directly with Orthodox and fertile couples to overcome the problems that face them. And I have to say that after 3 decades of doing this, the halakhic approach has definitely changed.
Right.
I mean, at the beginning of the era of IVF, major teshuvot and major poskim would say IVF was not allowed. And 5 million babies later, and in the Orthodox community, certainly hundreds of thousands of babies later, IVF has become an acceptable technique to use. The only halakhic debate is when to use it, on whom to use it, etc. One of the other things that I should mention, since you bring up the secular world,
right,
is that infertility in general is a very, very devastating situation for any couple. And couples who are religious but not living in the Jewish community always have a crisis of, if not belief, then an existential crisis, if you will, because of the rather biblical nature of infertility. But when you get into dealing with Torah observant couples who are suffering from infertility, there is certainly an even more dramatic level, which is that they not only have to deal with the religious and spiritual aspects of infertility, but they also have to deal, tachlis, if you will, with the day-to-day issues that come up with what is asur and what is mutar and what can be done specifically with some of the problems that arise in the area of family purity, hilchot nidah. And so there are very practical matters that need to be overcome specifically by Orthodox couples.
Right, and then in addition to what you just described in terms of halakha and ethics, there's also that sprinkling of social pressure that seems to also come into being when couples are suffering from infertility.
Oh, it's absolutely tremendous, the pressure that these couples are under. Let me give you just a little bit of an insight into what happens. You know, when a couple in the secular community gets married and they're both 25 years old and 2 or 3 years go by, nobody thinks twice about what's going on their end, because we know that most couples are going to be using contraception for the first few years of their marriage, sometimes for 5 or 10 years into their marriage. They electively choose not to have children. That is not characteristic at all within the Orthodox community, and I'd say that's the same in the spectrum from modern Orthodoxy all the way into the Haredi community. They tend to get married young, and there's an expectation that children will come fast. So if there's no pregnancy, by the time they're 6 months post the chuppah, all of a sudden it's everybody's business what's happening. And because the families are extended and they're close, there's a lot of pressure. Everybody's watching.
Oh, you've just described it to a T. It's really amazing what couples go through and how difficult it can be. And I'm sure all of that only adds tremendous anxiety to the entire experience. Dr. Richard Grazi via telephone. The book is called Overcoming Infertility. You're listening to Buy the Book here at the Nachum Segal Network. We'll talk about the format of the book for a moment. This is, how would we put it? It's really like an encyclopedic work. You've gone to experts in every, including yourself, in every area, in every aspect of the whole infertility battle, if you will. And you've asked them, I guess it seems to me, you've asked them to contribute and be part of this whole analysis.
And that's correct. And one of the reasons that I've done that is to protect myself from critique. After all, I'm not a rav, and although I do have a yeshiva background, I like to stay within the confines of my expertise. I've written the book, by the way, not only for the couples, but also for the rabbis who are being asked she'elot on these complicated issues. Because it is important for them to understand the medical and scientific basis for the problems that come to their office and to their consultation room. And I also want to open up the discussion. One of the problems that these couples face is that when they go to their local rav may not be expert in the area of fertility treatment. And just like I would not be overstepping my boundaries in terms of the medicine that I practice, I am trusting that anybody who is bothering to give a pesach halacha in the area of infertility would need to have the proper background before they give that pesach. This is, again, to open up the discussion. It's a small step. I have to say that there's barely a day that goes by that I am not on the phone with a rav who is counseling a couple. And one of the reasons for that is because the level of sophistication is very broad, ranging from novices to people who are truly specialized in reproductive halakha. And there is that concept of reproductive halakha, just like there is the concept of reproductive medicine. So you need experts on both ends in order to navigate this difficult area.
How long did it take, in your estimation, to reach a point where you could consult with a rabbi who was scientifically inclined enough to really grasp what you were asking?
It's not just scientifically inclined. That has taken, I would say, from the start of my practice here at Maimonides 26 years ago, probably at least 10 years until we saw the proper level of expertise, at least on the part of a core bunch of rabbis. But there are always new people coming to the fore. There are excellent rabbis who just need to sharpen up on reproductive halakha. And when they have questions and they ask me, when they reach out to me, then I know that we've been successful. The problem that I face, again, is that many times the questions go to Rabbanim who may not be expert in halakha, and that is the basis of a lot of the humrot that come the way of the couples that we treat.
Right.
And some of those humrot I understand, and sometimes they pose tremendous difficulties, obstacles, I would say, in the way of resolving infertility.
Is there anything, and again, you're not a rabbi, I make that clear to the audience, and I can only expect from you, you know, what your area of expertise brings, but therefore, answer this in whatever way you can. Is there anything pre-20th century that goes into any of this? Are there responsa? Are there Talmudic passages? Is there anything that plays a role in any of the halachic process that's before the 20th century?
The answer is yes. A lot of the, I don't want to say pilpul because it has a pejorative ring to it, but a lot of the discussion with regard to matters such as insemination or use of donor eggs or surrogacy go back actually to passage in the Talmud itself, that have been thought to be relevant to today's science. Having said that, it's important to note that sperm and the function of sperm were not identified until the 17th century microscopically, and even then there was a lot of confusion about what the function of sperm were. And human eggs were not identified until the mid-19th century, and people didn't really know how that worked either. So there's a lot of confusion. Certainly genetics, the genetics of how DNA is amplified and is propagated through human reproduction was not worked out until well into this century. So a lot of the halakhic decisions are made with, I would say, a blind eye to the science of reproduction. On the other hand, modern poskim who are expert in reproductive halakha certainly make their decisions with an eye towards the science. And this is one of the exciting areas of halakha, because it shows us that halakha is living and always takes into account, or should take into account, the concept of the chai b'hem. I mean, we have to live our lives according to the knowledge that we have today, and at the same time, respectfully consider the mikorot that we have from days of yore.
Dr. Richard Grazi is with us. Overcoming Infertility is the name of the book. TobyPress.com for information. It's a Koren release, Toby Press being an imprint of our friends at Koren Publishers. This may sound like a crazy question, but I bet you have a very intelligent answer for it. A couple that has been trying for, I don't know, 2 years, 3 years, whatever length of time you want to describe, to have children, are they necessarily an infertile couple?
Oh, that's a very, very good question, because infertility usually has a medical basis.
Right.
And we define that as a couple who has not achieved pregnancy within a year of trying. The reason for that is 95% of couples with normal fertility will achieve a pregnancy within a year. Having said that, we certainly can see, especially in the Orthodox community, couples who are married for a number of years and who are not pregnant, not because of any physical or medical impediment, but because of sexual dysfunction, which I underline is a minor cause of infertility.
Right.
And even to mention the two in the same breath is problematic, because people tend to equate the two, and they generally are not. But one thing that is occasionally a problem, and we see it almost, I would say, we see it commonly in the reproductive medicine office, is the problem of halakhic infertility. And by that I mean women who are ovulating and who would have normal fertility, except for the fact that they are keeping taharat hamishpacha,
right,
and they ovulate during the time that they are nida. So technically they are not infertile, but they may have childless marriages that are going on for 2-3 years.
Right, or as regular folks like me would say, chalk it up to bad timing. Simple as that.
Yeah, unfortunate biological timing. That's correct.
Right.
But fortunately, there are ways to get around that medically by manipulation of the ovulatory cycle. It's really quite simple. There's some debate in the medical community about whether or not it's appropriate to give a woman medication when she does not have an underlying medical disorder. But as I have explained many times, and certainly it's a discussion that I've had many times with my own associates, is that within the Torah observant community, there are important things like having children, and then there's even more important things like keeping halakha.
Right.
And when keeping hilchot nida is what gets in the way of a couple having children, they would prefer not to have a child than to have to transgress that part of their life. So that part of Torah. So treating them medically in order to have them able to conceive is certainly something that I have no ethical problem with.
I asked you earlier in this conversation about halacha pre-20th century. What about fertility therapy pre-20th century? What would Dr. Grazi be doing 100 or 200 years ago? Was there any hope? Was there any advice? Was there any way, any direction to lead a couple who is in this type of situation?
Nothing that really worked. I want to give you an idea of the historic understanding of reproduction. What happened was everybody knew that a woman who was cycling regularly would miss her period, and then 9 months later she'd have a baby.
Right.
And the thought was that menstrual blood that just accumulated in the uterus over the course of those 9 months is what formed the baby. And that's how things work. And maybe there was some contribution from sperm, and they didn't know exactly how things work. After the identification of sperm microscopically, there are some neat drawings that scientists made where they thought they observed little tiny human beings, so-called homunculi, within the head of the sperm. And they thought that now they found a way that people reproduced. And when eggs were found in the mid-19th century, they thought that maybe the little baby, the little fetus was rolled up inside the egg, and there were schools called ovists and schools called spermists, and they didn't really know how things worked at all. In the 18th and 19th century, most of the treatment for infertility was directed towards female, because nobody even realized that a man who was sexually normal could be infertile at all.
Right.
So infertility was always blamed on women, and the various and sundry treatments that were given to them were really not based in any kind of normal physiology and had no effect at all.
What percent?
A lot of the treatments were designed to decrease stress, which was thought to cause infertility, and in fact, that's not true.
I apologize for interrupting. I'm just curious today what percentage of your patients you would attribute to male problems as opposed to female problems.
About 50% go to the male arena and 50% to the female. I should say it's really 40-40, and then about 20% of infertility is completely unexplained.
Huh, interesting. The 50 sounds, well, I guess, you know.
And that makes things so difficult halachically, because the rabbanim expect, and for good reason, that a good halachic reason, that any couple with infertility who presents needs to have a primary focus on the woman. So
right.
The woman needs to go through a battery of tests, and very often they'll say, don't even ask about evaluation of the male partner,
right,
before that complete testing is done. Whereas in the real world, it works exactly in the opposite direction, because testing men is so easy and inexpensive,
right,
and half the time you're going to find out the reason when you do a test on the man. So when you can test the man halakhically, after how long they need to be married, after what tests that need to be done, these are all questions that every couple needs to ask their own posek.
Is IVF, which now has become such a common thing that I think most people in our audience even know what it stands for, is it essentially the treatment, the method that is utilized to help couples in this situation?
In vitro fertilization, so-called because we fertilize the egg, and we do that usually with the husband's sperm, in vitro or in the laboratory dish,
right,
has been around for a very long time. The success rates keep climbing. About 1.5% of all births in the United States today are from in vitro fertilization cycles. So it's a fantastically successful treatment. But one should realize that most couples with infertility do not require IVF. We use IVF in couples that have indications for IVF, when there's a severe male factor, when the fallopian tubes are blocked, etc. It is true that sometimes the infertility is unexplained, and when you use traditional medical interventions, they don't work. And so we do use in vitro fertilization for those couples as well, but not as primary treatment. It is essentially the ultimate backup that we use.
So should I assume that medication and other methods are used first?
Sure. Sometimes the couple just needs the counseling. Sometimes, right. Especially in a woman who doesn't ovulate, she just needs medication to make her ovulate. So for those couples, the intervention can be very simple. There are some women who need minor surgical procedures in order to restore a normal pelvic anatomy, and they can get pregnant on their own afterwards. So not infertility treatment does not, and I repeat, does not equal IVF.
In the IVF treatment, rabbis require there to be supervision. Is that a big deal, and what do I mean by that? I don't mean this is a big deal halakhically, which I assume it is. What I do mean is in the procedure, in the day-to-day accomplishment of that type of treatment, does it add any type of difficulty to what you have to do because someone is involved to make sure everything is supervised properly, or it's simply a supervisory step that, you know, you barely notice?
Well, let me tell you what our experience has been. Your listeners have to know that a doctor who works out of Maimonides Medical Center and whose office is in Brooklyn has to be sensitive to patients who are coming from Borough Park and Williamsburg and Flatbush, right. And Muncie and neighborhoods where the idea of going to a restaurant without proper hashkacha is anathema, right. Let alone going to a reproductive program where the stakes are much bigger than, God forbid, somebody should eat trace, what they are worried about. And,
right.
And I think the Rabbanim were ahead of their time in being concerned about this, that there should be no mistakes and, God forbid, nothing nefarious going on in the laboratory that may be hidden from the couple. So we've had a program of hashkacha or rabbinical supervision at our laboratory since day one. And because it's such a natural thing, it's ongoing, it's run by Rabbi Friedlander, who's the chaplain at Maimonides Medical Center, who has a team of mashgichim and mashgichot that are on call for just this purpose. All of the staff, the nursing staff, the laboratory staff, they are all looking at this as part and parcel of the way that we treat patients and the way that we're sensitive to their cultural and religious needs. So to answer the question, having rabbinical supervision within the IVF lab does not pose any obstacles or difficulties to the staff,
right.
Whatsoever.
Barely noticeable, I would guess.
Yes, they're behind the scenes. Patients coming in who require hashkacha, obviously they know who the mashgiach is or the mashgicha is, and that person will identify himself or herself to the couple. But in terms of getting those people, the rabbinical supervisors, then this is just a normal step for many of our couples.
When Overcoming Infertility was released years ago, the foreword was written by the late Lord Emanuel Jacobovitz, obviously a very well-known name to so many people out there. Did he have a special, I don't know, affinity or a special direction when it came to this topic, or simply because of his prominence he was asked to participate in the book?
It was mainly because of his prominence and also because he was the person who brought the idea of Jewish medical ethics to the fore, and he was the decisor par excellence in that field.
As simple as
that.
So
that was my way of reaching out to him and showing him what we were doing.
And how did you decide in terms of, I see from the articles that you're responsible for in the book, it can get very medically technical. But I would assume, based on what you said toward the outset, that if a rabbi or anybody really interested in this field is going to get a grasp of it, every one of these details is very important.
That's correct. They have to know the science behind a lot of what we do. And one of the reasons why it is so technical and so detailed is because we have to fight so much mythology about fertility and infertility that's out there. You know, sometimes when I speak to my patients and I hear the things that they've been told, it seems to me that everyone who's ever had a baby considers himself or herself a fertility specialist. And that just is not so. And the things that we deal with are extraordinarily complex, and they do require some study, just the same way that poskening any kind of halakhic problem requires study and is not beyond the scope of any rabbi to learn.
Dr. Grazi, there are doctors out there in so many different areas, and obviously many of them have great success stories, thank God, and a lot of lives are being saved. And unfortunately, we know that things don't always go the way we would wish them to go. I would guess even in your area, you experience a lot of that. You have tremendous success stories, thank God. It must be, I don't know if frustrating is the right word. It must be an agonizing experience when there's a couple who you simply cannot help.
That is correct. Let me tell you, I consider myself to be really the most fortunate person to have been involved in this area of medicine from the get-go, and to have had the opportunity to help so many people, not only directly but indirectly through my book. But there is no question that there are couples for whom no answer can be found. And that's particularly the case because sometimes the solution is there, but the solution is not halakhically acceptable to the couple. So, for example, in any reproductive medicine program, there are couples using egg donors, sperm donors, surrogates. These are techniques with which many couples, for whatever the reason, could be from themselves personally or because of their POSEC or what they have told them, they're just not comfortable availing themselves of these types of techniques. And you know, in the field of infertility, the biggest problem that we deal with, the biggest, is ovarian aging. The concept is that girls are born with all their eggs, and they never make new eggs. It's one of the fundamental differences between men and women, physiologically speaking, that men continuously replenish their gamete supply, their sperm supply, through their reproductive life, but women don't do that. They are born with a set amount of eggs, and the rate of depletion or diminishment of that egg supply is determined probably genetically at the time that they're born. So many women will show up, of course, in their 40s because they're either married late or they remarried, and they're just either out of eggs or they're out of good eggs in order to establish a pregnancy. And lo aleinu, but sometimes this happens not in the 40s. It happens in the 30s, and sometimes it happens when a woman is in her 20s, and sometimes they show up with this problem even as teenagers. And when they're single, it's really a problem in terms of shiduch. So when we're faced with a problem of what we call diminished egg reserve, and the only solution would be to use an egg from another person, obviously it's a tremendous problem halakhically and socially and psychologically. And those are the couples who can't be helped, couples who need sperm donors also, et cetera. So there is not always, there usually is a medical answer, but that medical answer is not always acceptable within the Torah observant community.
And there is, and now I'll really show my medical ignorance, and there is a way to know all this before she's even trying to have a kid.
Well, that's where biology is really unfair to women. I have to apologize on behalf of biology to patients on a regular basis. You know, there are boys that have very severe sperm problems, not only because they've been through some kind of cancer treatment, but just because they have a genetic syndrome that they're not aware of. But there's no semen, there's no sign for a boy that he may have diminished fertility. For a girl, obviously, there is a sign because she may have irregular periods or none at all.
Right.
And this is a problem when it comes to the four, and she's not even married yet. And we've seen all kinds of social issues related to this problem, and they're very complicated and not for discussion on the radio.
It's interesting, you know, and it's strange I would bring this up at this point in the conversation after a negative aspect that you just mentioned. But do you, with all the things, all the epiphanies and all the things that you mention, you think about in terms of the big picture. When thinking about what you just described, you must sometimes stop and say, my God, hasn't God created the most fascinating machine in the human being? I mean, it must be remarkable sometimes when you sit back and just think about the type of mechanism that all of us have developed inside of us.
Well, Nahum, I thank you for bringing up that point, because it reminds me to tell you that from my point of view, it's impossible to do this kind of work without, you know, we regularly, in the context of an IVF cycle, certainly, I mean, I'm holding a human embryo in my hand and watching this go into the uterus of my patient, and then a few weeks later seeing a little fetus with a heartbeat and watching that happen. It's impossible to really, for a person who has any kind of spiritual background, to be in that environment and not to look up on a regular basis and just say, you know, Manoram Asheka, just, you know, you feel something spiritual happening. And that's why I find it fundamentally curious that there are other religions for whom in vitro fertilization is prohibited. I mean, this is, to me, it's Hashem's way of revealing himself to people, to have delivered to us this technology where we're able to work with nature in this way. It is overwhelmingly awesome.
Unbelievable. Dr. Richard Grazi is with us. Final minutes coming up in our conversation about the book Overcoming Infertility. Dr. Grazi is director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at Maimonides Medical Center, founder of Genesis Fertility and Reproductive Medicine in New York. He's been recognized for 6 consecutive years by New York Magazine as Best Doctor for Reproductive Medicine. First book of his was entitled Be Fruitful and Multiply, Fertility Therapy in the Jewish Tradition. We're recommending Overcoming Infertility as well. Overcoming Infertility, A Guide for Jewish Couples, is a Toby Press release. You can go to tobypress.com, T-O-B-Y-Press.com. It's, of course, an imprint of our friends at Koren Publications. We are in the midst of this week's conversation about the world of books. By the book, brought to you by our friends at Koren Publications. I do want to remind everybody we are in the midst right now, if you're listening to this in first run format on a Tuesday at 10 a.m., we're in the midst of our JM and the AM fundraising marathon, which keeps the flagship program of this network going on an annual basis. If you have not yet contributed, check out all the details at jmandtheam.org. Again, that's jmandtheam.org, and contribute as generously as possible. Dr. Grazi, would it be wrong for me to ask? Maybe it will be. I don't know. You'll tell me. I'm so curious about some of the rabbinic leaders who might be familiar to me and my listeners who have been at the forefront of this whole issue. I mean, if we did hear the list or heard from you, you know, one or two names, would we be surprised at who we would find at the top of that list who have become amazing decisors in the area of infertility and halacha?
I don't think that you would be surprised to know that Rav Eliashiv Zatzal was a major person in this field. Chaim Ovadia Yosef and Mordechai Eliyahu Zatzal, also tremendous leaders within this field. And these leaders were counted on by organizations like Machon Pu'ah and Eitim and Bonei Olam to give halakhic guidance over the years. And of course, there are local poskim as well. It goes without saying that it's not proper to mention anybody less than Gadol,
right,
because I don't want to exclude anybody. But one of the things that that's important to know is that when we think of Orthodoxy, this is not a monolithic community. Not everybody holds by the same pose. So that something that might be mutar to do l'chachila for one pose is absolutely asur in the opinion of another. And so, to say, well, you know, I'm I'm holding by the Gadol Hador. You know, the Gadol Hador for you may be a different person than the Gadol Hador for me.
Right.
And one of the dilemmas that we face in the office is that we have to hold by whoever the couple's posek is. I'm not doing things with Orthodox couples in order to satisfy the needs or the viewpoint of one particular community. There is a spectrum of belief, a spectrum of practice, and a spectrum of halakhic decisions that follows the spectrum of Orthodoxy, all the way from, again, modern Orthodoxy to the Haredi community. And when we're practicing medicine, we can't let one trump the other. It's whatever is appropriate for the couple who is sitting in front of us and needs proper care.
Boy, I'm only laughing because I'm thinking of how difficult that must be for someone like yourself to juggle all that.
It is very difficult, especially because sometimes I think that that there's an opinion from the Rabbanim that all we want to do is make our patients do Averas. But of course, it's not true. It's not my place to tell a couple who lives in Flatbush that they have to go buy a posek in Muncie or vice versa. It doesn't work that way. There is no kavyachol, pope, for Jewish people.
Right.
And so that's the way that our halakhic system works. And I have to be fair to my patients, I have to work within the guidelines that make them feel comfortable.
I think some of the rabbis' attitudes, and I'm saying some because I don't know if it's all, you could tell us if it is, I think some of the rabbis' attitudes towards Shabbos and Yontif and its role or what its role needs to be in relation to infertility and IDF and IVF treatments is somewhat interesting. Did that catch you somewhat by surprise when you saw a direction by rabbis who authorized that certain things need to be done on a Shabbos or Yontif because of the important nature of your work?
It surprises me in a certain sense, and a lot of the basis for that has to do with whether a couple or an individual who is suffering from infertility is considered to be a sick person, in danger,
right,
or not in danger, and whether or not we are in the Mechalel Shabbat for that person. But I have to tell you that to me, a lot of the discussion is irrelevant. I've been doing this, as I mentioned before, for 26 years,
right,
and I can tell you that we have virtually never been in a situation where we've asked a person to even think about being the Halal Shabbat. There are so many ways to approach medical protocols and to approach treatment protocols and options and start times, etc., that easily allow us to get around Shabbat. So I don't know why there is so much talk about coming in and doing monitoring and doing procedures on Shabbat. It really, if that happens, it means that the doctor is not considering the couple's religious needs when he or she is formulating their treatment plan.
Very interesting. So you've just told us something very, very important. This I know for a fact, that there are people out there that sometimes need to work around the whole Shabbos and Yontif issue. But you're saying that if a doctor is conscious enough of their personal situation, he'll make sure that from his end they work around and they won't have to worry about it at all.
Absolutely. I'm aware of this, and some of the people who work with me, I have from people who work on my staff, and we see what's going out there and what's going on there in the community of infertility, and we're saying, you know, I need a hotel for Shabbos, and I need to go in for monitoring. I need a blood test, and you know, we keep scratching our heads. Why is this happening? Why does this have to be when we're able to treat our patients with success rates that are just as good, if not better? And we don't have these problems on Shabbat. And the only conclusion that we can make is that the treatments leading up to those problems have not been done in consideration of the couple's ultimate need to not be present on Shabbat.
Wow, I'm so glad you mentioned that. Dr. Grazi, finally, I will ask you, what's it like? What's it like when you see a family, 4, 5, 6, 7 kids, and you know that you and your staff, without you and your staff, they probably would not be a family of such numbers? What is your feeling when that happens?
Well, Nachum, I grew up in Brooklyn. I live in Brooklyn. I live in an Orthodox community. I'm in Beit Knesset. I'm in the street. I see our patients all the time, and Baruch Hashem that he's given me the privilege to have such a meaningful relationship with so many people over the years. And I hope that Hashem keeps not only me strong to do this for the long term, but also my staff. And we're planning a move to a new facility soon that's going to be even closer to the Orthodox community in Bensonhurst. And we hope that Hashem continues to smile on us and our patients and to give us haslacha.
Dr. Grazi, what an honor to speak with you. Thanks so much for taking so much time to spend with me today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Richard Grazi, Overcoming Infertility is the name of the book. I thank him for joining us here on a Tuesday at the Nachum Segal Network. I remind everybody that Overcoming Infertility, A Guide for Jewish Couples by Dr. Richard Grazi on the topic of fertility therapy in the Jewish tradition is available. It's a Toby Press release, TOBYPress.com, TOBYPress.com. It is an imprint of our friends at Koren Publications. Koren brings you this segment entitled Buy the Book every single week, Tuesdays, first run format at 10 a.m. Eastern Time here at the Nachum Segal Network. I also want to remind everybody our JM and the AM fundraising marathon is on. Those of you who have not yet had an opportunity to support JM and the AM and keep it going for another year, log on to jmandam.org and make sure to do that at some point today, and your help with that is greatly appreciated. Our friends at Koren continue to give us amazing authors, fantastic books, and just incredible guests to speak with on such a variety of topics. We recommend Overcoming Infertility, A Guide for Jewish Couples by Dr. Richard Grazi. And, of course, we continuously recommend the incredible works by Koren. The Rabbi Sachs Haggadah, by the way, is being offered as one of the incentives to support JM and the AM during our fund drive over these 2 weeks. Details, you'll see it on the list of items that are available as gifts when you give to JM the AM. Again, just go to jmtheam.org. When you hit the pledge box, you'll see exactly what I mean. I want to thank our friends at Koren Publications, and I want to thank Dr. Grazi, another great edition of Buy the Book here on a Tuesday at the Nachum Segal Network. And I remind everybody that I remind everybody that you should stay tuned to the Nachum Segal Network for wonderful music, and if you are listening to this in its first-run fashion on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, the Tuesday Live Lunch with ZK will follow at 11 a.m. My thanks to our friends at Koren Publications. Check out korenpub.com. This is the Nachum Segal Network. Thank you.